When we reach this place, even momentarily, we belong everywhere and nowhere. That seems absurd, but it's true. Carl Jung argued that a paradox is one of our most valued spiritual possessions and a great witness to the truth. It makes sense to me that we're called to combat the spiritual crisis of disconnection with one of our most valued spiritual possessions. Bearing witness to the truth is rarely easy, especially when we're alone in the wilderness. But as Maya Angelou tells us, the price is high, the reward is great. Chapter 3. High Lonesome, A Spiritual Crisis. Story has it that as a child, Bill Monroe would hide in the woods next to a railroad track in what he called the long, old, straight bottom part of Kentucky. Bill would watch World War I veterans returning home from the war as they walked along the track. The weary soldiers would sometimes let out long hollers, loud, high-pitched, bone-chilling hollers of pain and freedom that cut through the air like the blare of a siren. Whenever John Hartford, an acclaimed musician and composer, tells this story, he lets out a holler of his own. The minute you hear it, you know it. Oh, that holler. It's not a spirited yippee or a painful wail, but something in between. It's a holler that's thick with both misery and redemption. A holler that belongs to another place and time. Bill Monroe would eventually become known as the father of bluegrass music. During his legendary career, he often told people that he practiced that holler, and he always reckoned that that's where his singing style came from. Today, we call that sound High Lonesome. High Lonesome is a sound or type of music in the bluegrass tradition. Its roots go back to Bill Monroe, Roscoe Holcomb, and the bluegrass region of Kentucky. It's a kind of music I find arresting and hard and full of pain. When I hear Roscoe Holcomb singing, "I'm a man of constant sorrow," a cappella, like an arrow piercing the air, the hair on the back of my neck stands up. And I get goosebumps when I hear Bill Monroe's, "I'm blue, I'm lonesome." When you hear that holler over the thumping mandolins and banjos, you can feel the heaviness of those soldiers' hollers. And you can even faintly make out the sound of a distant train chugging down the tracks. Art has the power to render sorrow beautiful, make loneliness a shared experience, and transform despair into hope. Only art can take the holler of a returning soldier and turn it into a shared expression and a deep collective experience. Music, like all art, gives pain and our most wrenching emotions voice, language, and form, so it can be recognized and shared. The magic of the High Lonesome sound is the magic of all art. It's the ability to both capture our pain and deliver us from it at the same time. When we hear someone else sing about the jagged edges of heartache or the unspeakable nature of grief, we immediately know we're not the only ones in pain. The transformative power of art is in the sharing. Without connection or collective engagement, what we hear is simply a caged song of sorrow and despair. We find no liberation in it. It's the sharing of art that whispers, "You're not alone." The world feels high lonesome and heartbroken to me right now. We've sorted ourselves into factions based on our politics and ideology. We've turned away from one another and toward blame and rage. We're lonely and untethered and scared. So damn scared. But rather than coming together and sharing our experiences through song and story, we're screaming at each other from further and further away. Rather than dancing and praying together, we're running from one another. Rather than pitching wild and innovative new ideas that could potentially change everything, we're staying quiet and small in our bunkers and loud in our echo chambers. When I look through the 200,000-plus pieces of data my team and I have collected over the past 15 years, I can only conclude that our world is in a collective spiritual crisis. This is especially true if you think back about that core definition of spirituality from the Gifts of Imperfection. Remember, spirituality is recognizing and celebrating that we are all inextricably connected to each other by a power greater than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. Right now, we are neither recognizing nor celebrating our inextricable connection. We are divided from others in almost every area of our lives. We're not showing up with one another in a way that acknowledges our connection. Cynicism and distrust have a stranglehold on our hearts. And rather than continuing to move toward a vision of shared power among people, we're witnessing a backslide to a vision of power that is key to the autocrat's power over people. Addressing this crisis will require a tremendous amount of courage. For the moment, most of us are either making the choice to protect ourselves from conflict, discomfort, and vulnerability by staying quiet, or picking sides and in the process slowly and paradoxically adopting the behavior of the people we're fighting. Either way, the choices we're making to protect our beliefs and ourselves are leaving us disconnected, afraid, and lonely. Very few people are working on connection outside the lines drawn by their side. Finding love and true belonging in our shared humanity is going to take tremendous resolution. My hope is that this research will shed light on why our quest for true belonging requires that we brave some serious wilderness. Let's look at several of the reasons behind the crisis, starting with the birth of factions. This next section is called Sorting Ourselves Out, and I want to start by reading a quote for you from Bill Bishop. Bill Bishop writes, "As people seek out the social settings they prefer, as they choose the group that makes them feel the most comfortable, the nation grows more politically segregated, and the benefit that ought to come with having a variety of opinions is lost to the righteousness that is the special entitlement of homogeneous groups. We all live with the results. Balkanized communities whose inhabitants find other Americans to be culturally incomprehensible. A growing intolerance for political differences that has made national consensus impossible. And politics so polarized that Congress is stymied and elections are no longer just contests over policies, but bitter choices between ways of life." This quote is from Bill Bishop's book, The Big Sort. He wrote it in 2009. But given the state of our country after the 2016 election and what we see happening across the globe, he'll likely need to call his sequel The Biggest Sort Ever. Bishop's book tells the story of how we've geographically, politically, and even spiritually sorted ourselves into like-minded groups in which we silence dissent, grow even more extreme in our thinking, and consume only the facts that support our beliefs, making it even easier to ignore evidence that our positions are wrong. Bishop writes, "As a result, we now live in a giant feedback loop, hearing our own thoughts about what's right and wrong bounced back to us by the television shows we watch, the newspapers and books we read, the blogs we visit online, the sermons we hear, and the neighborhoods we live in." This sorting leads to us making assumptions about the people around us, too, which in turn fuels disconnection. Most recently, a friend, who clearly doesn't know me very well, told me that I should read Joe Badgett's book, Deer Hunting with Jesus. When I asked him why, he answered with contempt in his voice, "So you can better understand the part of America that college professors have never seen and will never understand." I thought, you don't know a damn thing about me, my family, or where I come from. And as fast as we're sorting ourselves, the people around us are hustling to sort us too, so they know what to do and say, and so they can decide why they should trust us or why they shouldn't. My friend was hoping a book would help me understand his America. But as it turns out, it's an America I already know well. It's full of people I love. And yet, for those sharing the preconceptions of my friend, it's an America I'm not supposed to know, much less hail from. This kind of misperception is likely to be the case for the majority of people listening to this. Things are not that simple, because we're not that simple. I'm a professor whose grandfather was a teamster, a forklift driver, at a brewery. Steve is a pediatrician whose grandmother, a Mexican immigrant, sewed dresses at a factory in downtown San Antonio. The sorting we do to ourselves and to one another is, at best, unintentional and reflexive. At worst, it's stereotyping that dehumanizes. The paradox is that we all love the ready-made filing system. It's so handy when we want to quickly characterize people. But yet we resent it when we're the ones getting filed away. In the months following the 2016 election and the January inauguration, thousands of emails came in from our community members asking for advice on how to handle the divisiveness that was sweeping not just through the country, but also through people's living rooms. Unlike the sordid demographic of our country, my community remains pretty diverse, so the emails I received were from both sides of the aisle. They were from people explaining how they hadn't spoken to their father or mother for weeks, or describing how an argument over social policy led directly to a discussion about divorce. I remember when the rhetoric was at an all-time high. This was around Thanksgiving. The big joke was about buying plastic knives and forks for family dinners to avoid casualties during the holiday feast. All I could think about then was Veronica Roth's dystopian novel, Divergent, in which people choose factions based on their personalities. The axiom was faction before blood. More than family, our factions are where we belong. Now that's scary. But what's even scarier is that it's starting to edge closer to our reality than the nightmarish fiction it was conceived to be. Walking away from people we know and love because of our support for strangers we really don't know, can barely believe, and definitely don't love, who for sure won't be there to drive us to chemo or bring food over when the kids are sick. That is the shadow side of sorting. Family is the one group that most of us choose to negotiate rather than sort out of our lives. Even if the polarizing politics of recent events have unmasked some core value differences between us and the people we love, severing that connection feels like a last resort, a consequence implemented only after vulnerable, tough conversations and boundary settings have failed entirely. For 20 years, I've had the great privilege of teaching at the University of Houston. It is the most racially and ethnically diverse research university in the United States. A couple of semesters ago, I asked a class of 60 graduate students if their beliefs were aligned with their grandmother's or grandfather's political, social, and cultural beliefs. Now, this is a group of students that reflect the amazing diversity of our university in terms of race, sexual orientation, and identity, and cultural background. About 15% of the students said yes, or pretty close. 85% of students described everything from mild embarrassment to mortification when it came to the politics of their family members. One African-American student explained how he saw eye to eye with his grandparents on just about every issue, except the one that was most important for him. He couldn't come out to his grandfather despite the fact that his entire family knew he was gay. His grandfather was a retired pastor and was, in his words, dug in around homosexuality. A white student talked about her father's habit of addressing waiters in Mexican restaurants with, "Hola, Pancho." She had a Latino boyfriend and said it was humiliating. But when I asked if they hated their grandparents or were willing to sever relationships with family members over the political and social divides, the answer was no across the board. It is, of course, more complicated than that. So here's the big question. Wouldn't you think that all of the sorting by politics and beliefs that we've been doing would lead to more social interaction? Look, if we've hunkered down ideologically and geographically with people who we perceive to be just like us, doesn't that mean that we've surrounded ourselves with friends and people with whom we feel deeply connected? Shouldn't "you're either with us or against us" have led to closer ties among the like-minded? The answer to these questions is a resounding and surprising no. At the very same time sorting is on the rise, so is loneliness. According to Bishop, the author of The Big Sort, in 1976, less than 25% of Americans lived in places where the presidential election was a landslide. In other words, we lived next door to and attended school and worshiped with people who held different beliefs than ours. We were ideologically diverse. In contrast, in 2016, 80% of U.S. counties gave either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton a landslide victory. Most of us no longer even live near people who are all that different from us in terms of political and social beliefs. Now, let's compare these numbers to what's happening in the realm of loneliness. In 1980, approximately 20% of Americans reported feeling lonely. Today, it's more than double that percentage. And this is not just a local issue. Rates of loneliness are rapidly increasing around the world. Clearly, selecting like-minded friends and neighbors and separating ourselves as much as possible from people whom we think is different from us has not delivered on that deep sense of belonging that we're hardwired to crave. To understand this, we have to better understand what it means to be lonely and how the loneliness epidemic is affecting the way we show up with one another. On the outside, looking in. The neuroscience researcher John Cacioppo of the University of Chicago has been studying loneliness for over 20 years. He defines loneliness as perceived social isolation. We experience loneliness when we feel disconnected. Maybe we've been pushed to the outside of a group that we value, or maybe we're lacking a sense of true belonging. At the heart of loneliness is the absence of meaningful social interaction. An intimate relationship, friendships, family gatherings, or even community or work group connections. It's important to note that loneliness and being alone are very different things. Being alone or inhabiting solitude can be a powerful and healing thing. As an introvert, I deeply value alone time, and I often feel the loneliest when I'm with other people. In our house, we call that sense of being disconnected the lonely feeling. I can't tell you the number of times I've called Steve from the road and said, "I've got the lonely feeling." The cure is normally a quick chat with him and the kids. It seems counterintuitive, but Steve then usually advises, "Hey, you may need some time alone in your hotel room." To me, it's a great cure. I don't think there's anything lonelier than being with people and feeling alone. Our family uses the term the lonely feeling to describe all types of things. It's not unusual for Ellen or Charlie to say, "I don't like that restaurant. It gives me the lonely feeling." Or, "Can my friend spend the night here? Her house gives me the lonely feeling." When the four of us tried to drill down on what the lonely feeling meant for our family, we all agreed that we get the lonely feeling in places that don't feel alive with connection. For that reason, I think places themselves, not just people, can hold those feelings of disconnection too. Sometimes a place can feel lonely because of some lack of closeness in the relationships that happen in that space. Other times, I think the inability to visualize yourself in connection with people you care about in a particular place makes a space feel lonely on its own. While there's deep alignment between what I've found in my research and what Cacioppo has found, it wasn't until I processed his work that I fully understood the important role loneliness plays in our lives. He explains that as members of a social species, we don't derive strength from our rugged individualism, but rather from our collective ability to plan, communicate, and work together. Our neural, hormonal, and genetic makeup support interdependence over independence. He explains, "To grow to adulthood as a social species, including humans, is not to become autonomous and solitary. It's to become the one on whom others can depend. Whether we know it or not, our brain and our biology have been shaped to favor this outcome." Man, that made so much sense to me. Of course we're a social species. That's why connection matters. It's why shame is so painful and debilitating. It's why we're wired for belonging. Cacioppo explains how the biological machinery of our brains warns us when our ability to thrive and prosper is threatened. Hunger is a warning sign that our blood sugar is low and that we need to eat. Thirst warns us that we need to drink to avoid dehydration. Pain alerts us to potential tissue damage. And loneliness tells us that we need social connection, something as critical to our well-being as food and water. He explains, "Denying you feel lonely makes no more sense than denying you feel hunger." Yet, we do deny our loneliness. As someone who studies shame, I find myself back in territory that I know well. We feel shame around being lonely, as if feeling lonely means there's something wrong with us. We feel shame even when our loneliness is caused by grief, loss, or heartbreak. Cacioppo believes much of the stigma around loneliness comes from how we have defined it and talked about it for years. We used to define loneliness as gnawing, chronic disease without redeeming features. It was equated with shyness, depression, being a loner or antisocial, or possessing bad social skills. He gives a great example of this by noting how often we use the term loner to describe a criminal or a bad guy. Cacioppo explains that loneliness is not just a sad condition. It's a dangerous one. The brains of social species have evolved to respond to the feeling of being pushed to the social perimeter, being on the outside, by going into self-preservation mode. When we feel isolated, disconnected, and lonely, we try to protect ourselves. In that mode, we want to connect, but our brain is attempting to override connection with self-protection. That means less empathy, more defensiveness, more numbing, and less sleeping. In Rising Strong, I wrote about how the brain's self-protection mode often ramps up the stories we tell ourselves about what's happening, creating stories that are often not true or exaggerate our worst fears and insecurities. Unchecked, loneliness fuels continued loneliness by keeping us afraid to reach out. To combat loneliness, we must first learn how to identify it and to have the courage to see that experience as a warning sign. Our response to that warning sign should be to find connection. That doesn't necessarily mean joining a bunch of groups or checking in with dozens of friends. Numerous studies confirm that it's not the quantity of friends, but the quality of a few relationships that actually matters. If you're like me and you find yourself questioning the idea that starvation and loneliness are equally life-threatening, let me share the study that really brought all of this home for me. In a meta-analysis of studies on loneliness, researchers Julianne Holt Lunstead, Timothy B. Smith, and J. Bradley Layton found the following. Living with air pollution increases your odds of dying early by 5%. Living with obesity increases your odds of dying early by 20%. Excessive drinking, that raises your odds by 30%. And living with loneliness, that increases our odds of dying early by 45%. Fear is how we got here. So how did we get so sordid and lonely? We can't assume that sorting ourselves is the reason we've become lonelier. That's not how research works. We just can't make that leap. We can, however, acknowledge that we're in trouble in a number of dimensions that may be related, and we need to understand all of them if we want to change that. Any answer to the question, how did we get here, is certain to be complex. But if I had to identify one core variable that drives and magnifies our compulsion to sort ourselves into factions, while at the same time cutting ourselves off from real connection with other people, my answer would be fear. Fear of vulnerability, fear of getting hurt, fear of the pain of disconnection, fear of criticism and failure, fear of conflict, fear of not measuring up, fear. I started my research 6 months before 9/11, and as I've written elsewhere, I've watched fear change us. I've watched fear ride roughshod over our families, organizations, and communities. Our national conversation is centered on what should we fear and who should we blame. I'm not an expert on terrorism, but I've studied fear for over 15 years, and here's what I can tell you. Terrorism is time-released fear. The ultimate goal of both global and domestic terrorism is to conduct strikes that embed fear so deeply in the heart of a community that fear becomes a way of life. This unconscious way of living then fuels so much anger and blame that people start to turn on one another. Terrorism is most effective when we allow fear to take root in our culture. Then it's only a matter of time before we become fractured, isolated, and driven by our perceptions of scarcity. While the trends in sorting and loneliness predate 9/11, data show that they've grown significantly in the past 15 years. In a hardwired way, the initial trauma and devastation of violence unites human beings for a relatively short period of time. If during that initial period of unity we're allowed to talk openly about our collective grief and fear, if we turn to one another in a vulnerable and loving way while at the same time seeking justice and accountability, it can be the start to a very long healing process. If, however, what unites us is a combination of shared hatred and stifled fear that's eventually expressed as blame, we're in trouble. If leaders race too quickly to serve up an ideological enemy that we can rally against, rather than methodically identifying the actual perpetrator, what we experience is an emotional diversion away from the unraveling that's really happening in our homes and communities. The flags are flying from every porch and the social media memes are trending. All the while, fear is burrowing and metastasizing. What feels like a rallying movement is really a cover for fear, which can then start spreading over the landscape and seeping into the fault lines of our country. As fear hardens, it expands and becomes less of a protective barrier and more of a solidifying division. It forces its way down in the gaps and tears apart our social foundation, already weakened with those delicate cracks. And it's not just global and domestic terrorism that embeds fear in our cultures. Pervasive, random gun violence and systemic attacks against groups of people and the growing vitriol on social media, all of these send fear like hot lava flowing across our communities, filling in the holes and eventually working to ravage already fragile and broken places. In the case of the United States, our three greatest fault lines, cracks that have grown and deepened due to willful neglect and a collective lack of courage, are race, gender, and class. The fear and uncertainty flowing from collective trauma of all kinds have exposed those gaping wounds in a way that's been both profoundly polarizing and necessary. These are conversations that need to happen. This is discomfort that must be felt. Still, as much as it's time to confront these and other issues, we have to acknowledge that our lack of tolerance for vulnerable, tough conversation is driving our self-sorting and disconnection. Can we find our way back to ourselves and to each other and still keep fighting for what we believe in? No and yes. No, not everyone will be able to do both simply because some people will continue to believe that fighting for what they need means denying the humanity of others. That makes connecting outside of our bunkers impossible. I do believe, however, that most of us can build connection across difference and fight for our beliefs if we're willing to listen and lean into vulnerability. Mercifully, it will only take a critical mass of people who believe in finding love and connection across difference to change everything. But if we're not even willing to try, the value of what we're fighting for will be profoundly diminished. The data that emerged from the research on true belonging can start to connect some of the dots around why we're sorted but lonely, and perhaps contribute new insight into how we can reclaim authenticity and connection. True belonging has no bunkers. We have to step out from behind the barricades of self-preservation and brave the wild. Huddled behind the bunkers, we don't have to worry about being vulnerable or brave or trusting. We just have to toe the party line. Except doing that is not working. Ideological bunkers protect us from everything except loneliness and disconnection. In other words, we're not protected from the worst heartbreaks of all. In the remainder of this book, we're going to look at how we can reclaim human connection and true belonging in the midst of sorting and withdrawal. We have to find our way back to one another or fear wins. If you've read my work before, you'll know that it's not going to be easy. Like all meaningful endeavors, it's going to require vulnerability and the willingness to choose courage over comfort. We'll have to get through, or even better, learn how to become the wilderness. High Lonesome can be a beautiful and powerful place if we can own our pain and share it instead of inflicting pain on others. And if we can find a way to feel hurt rather than spread hurt, we can change. I believe in a world where we can make and share art and words that will help us find our way back to one another. That instead of yelling from afar and refusing to help each other when we're struggling, we'll find the courage to show up for each other. As Townes Van Zandt sings in one of my favorite High Lonesome songs, "If I Needed You." He sings, "I would come to you. I would swim the seas for to ease your pain." Chapter 4. People are hard to hate close up. Move in. I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain. James A. Baldwin. If we zoom way out and take a wide-angle shot of our world that's increasingly defined by 24-hour news, politics, and social media, we see a whole lot of hatred. We see posturing, name-calling, and people trading humiliations. We see politicians making laws that their own resources will exempt them from having to follow, and behaving in ways that would cost most of us our jobs, our families, and our dignity. On social media, we see opinions disembodied from accountability, truth, and worst of all, identity. But when we zoom in on our own life, the picture changes from a distant raging and atrophying heart to the beating pulse of our everyday existence. We feel love and we know pain. We feel hope and we know struggle. We see beauty and we survive trauma. We don't all have the protection of privilege and the luxury of anonymity. We're trying to build connected and loving lives while we pack lunches, drive carpools, go to jobs, and push into as many moments of joy as we can. As the larger world engages in what feels like a complete collapse of moral judgment and productive communication, the women and men I interviewed who had the strongest sense of true belonging stayed zoomed in. They didn't ignore what was happening in the world, nor did they stop advocating for their beliefs. They did, however, commit to assessing their lives and forming their opinions of people based on their actual in-person experiences. They worked against the trap that most of us have fallen into, a trap that plays a tape in our mind that says, hey, I can hate large groups of strangers because the members of those groups who I happen to know and like, they're the rare exceptions. Let's take a look at three examples from research participants. Number one. The political rhetoric says, Democrats are such losers. Your experience, as a lifelong conservative, that sounds about right. But what about your closest friend at work, the one who drove you to the hospital when you got the call that your husband had had a heart attack at the gym and was being rushed to the ER? The one who sat with you in the CICU, then raced to pick up your kids from school and take them to her house? The one who helped you plan the funeral and shouldered your workload while you were out? She's not a loser. In fact, you love her. And she's a Democrat. Number two, the political rhetoric is Republicans are selfish assholes. Your experience? You totally agree. Except for your son-in-law, who is a loving and wonderful husband to your son and the most amazing father to your granddaughter. Thank God he's in the family. Even more than your son, he's the one who sends you and your wife all the cute pictures and keeps you connected to your sweet granddaughter. He's not selfish. He's not an asshole. And he's a Republican. Number three, the political rhetoric. Anti-abortion activists are hypocrites and closed-minded fundamentalists. Your experience? As a feminist activist, you couldn't agree more. Except for that great teacher you had in your Catholic high school. She had more integrity than anyone you know, and she constantly encouraged you to think critically about tough issues, even when it meant disagreeing with her. She's actually the one who taught you how to be an effective activist. She's not a hypocrite or closed-minded, and she's pro-life. What if what we experience close up is real, and what we hear on the news and from the mouths of politicians who are jockeying for power, that needs to be questioned? It is not easy to hate people close up. And when we are in pain and fear, anger and hate are our go-to emotions. Almost everyone I've ever interviewed or known will tell you that it's easier to be pissed off than it is to be hurt or scared. I sometimes imagine what it would be like if I could put the entire world into a Word document and do a find and replace with the words and actions of hate versus pain. If I could replace the Sandy Hook deniers' hate with pain and my own hate for them with my own pain about what kind of world we live in when people do things like this. What would that conversation be like? Would it work? Would it work to ask the white supremacists about the pain that drives their hate and in turn creates so much pain and fear for others? Sometimes, I'll admit, I do not give a damn. There were periods during this research process where I felt like screaming, "Hey, you keep your true belonging, I'll keep my hate." My daughter got a book on going to college, and the first three chapters were essentially lessons on how not to get sexually assaulted. Do I really care about the pain that drives the drunk, violent assholes who make college campuses so dangerous that female students need to read a book about how to avoid those people? No. Screw you and screw the pain of the people who are causing pain. I will hold on to my sweet, self-righteous rage. But to what end? Not caring about our own pain and the pain of others is not working. How much longer are we willing to keep pulling drowning people out of the river one by one rather than walking to the headwaters of the river to find the source of the pain? What will it take for us to let go of that earned self-righteousness and travel together to the cradle of the pain that is throwing all of us in at such a rate that we couldn't possibly save everyone? Pain is unrelenting. It will get our attention. Despite our attempts to drown it in addiction, to physically beat it out of one another, to suffocate it with success and material trappings, or to strangle it with our hate, pain will find a way to make itself known. Pain will only subside when we acknowledge it and care for it. Addressing it with love and compassion would take only a minuscule percentage of the energy it takes to fight it. But approaching pain head on is terrifying. Most of us were not taught how to recognize pain, name it, and be with it. Our families and culture believed that the vulnerability that it takes to acknowledge pain was weakness. So we were taught anger, rage, and denial instead. But what we know now is that when we deny our emotion, it owns us. When we own our emotion, we can rebuild and find our way through the pain. Sometimes owning our pain and bearing witness to struggle means getting angry. When we deny ourselves the right to be angry, we deny our pain. There are a lot of coded shame messages in the rhetoric of, "Hey, why are you so hostile?" or "Don't get hysterical," or "Wow, I'm sensing so much anger," and "Hey, don't take it so personally." All of these responses are normally code for, "Your emotion or opinion is making me uncomfortable," or "Hey, suck it up and stay quiet." One response to this is, "Hey, everyone should just get angry and stay angry." I have not seen that advice borne out in the research. What I have found is that, yes, we all have the right and need to feel and own our anger. It's an important human experience. And it's critical to recognize that maintaining any level of rage, anger, or contempt, you know, contempt, that favorite concoction of a little anger and a little disgust, any attempt to maintain that over a long period of time is just not sustainable. Anger is a catalyst. Holding on to it will make us exhausted and sick. Internalizing anger will take away our joy and spirit. Externalizing anger will make us less effective in our attempts to create change and forge connection. It's an emotion that we need to transform into something life-giving. Courage, love, change, compassion, justice. Or sometimes anger can mask a far more difficult emotion like grief, regret, or shame. And we need to use it to dig into what we're really feeling. Either way, anger is a powerful catalyst, but a life-sucking companion. I can't think of a more powerful example than the sentence, "You will not have my hate." In November 2015, Antoine Laris's wife, Hélène, was killed by terrorists at the Bataclan Theater in Paris along with 88 other people. 2 days after the attacks, in an open letter to his wife's killers posted on Facebook, Laris wrote, "On Friday night, you stole the life of an exceptional being. the love of my life, the mother of my son. But you will not have my hate. I don't know who you are, and I don't want to know. You are dead souls. If that God for whom you blindly kill made us in his image, every bullet in my wife's body will have been a wound in his heart. So no, I will not give you the satisfaction of hating you. That is what you want. But to respond to your hate with anger would be to yield to the same ignorance that made you what you are. You want me to be scared, to see my fellow citizens through suspicious eyes, to sacrifice my freedom for security. You have failed. I will not change. Laris continues, there are only two of us, my son and myself, but we are stronger than all the armies of the world. Anyway, I don't have any more time to waste on you, as I must go see Melville, who is waking up from his nap. He is only 17 months old. He will eat a snack as he does every day, then we will play as we do every day. And all his life, this little boy will defy you by being happy and free, because you will not have his hate either. Courage is forged in pain, but not all pain. Pain that is denied or ignored becomes fear or hate. Anger that is never transformed becomes resentment and bitterness. I love what Nobel Peace Prize laureate Kailash Satyarthi says in his 2015 TED Talk. Anger is within each one of you, and I will share a secret for a few seconds. That if we are confined in the narrow shells of egos and the circles of selfishness, then the anger will turn out to be hatred, violence, revenge, destruction. But if we are able to break the circles, then the same anger could turn into a great power. We can break the circles by using our inherent compassion and connect with the world through compassion to make this world better. That same anger could be transformed into it. I believe that we pay for our hate with our lives, and that is just too big a price to pay. There are always boundaries, even in the wilderness. When we commit to getting closer, we're committing to eventually experiencing real face-to-face conflict. Whether it's over dinner, at work, or in the grocery line, in-person conflict is always hard and uncomfortable. And when it comes to family, it's even harder and more painful. If your family is anything like mine, you've been required to summon love and decency in the face of emotions that range from minor frustration to rage. Maintaining the courage to stand alone when necessary in the midst of family or community or angry strangers feels like an untamed wilderness. When I get to the point where I'm like, screw this, this is just too hard, I'm too lost, I hear Maya Angelou's words again. The price is high, the reward is great. But here's a question that came up for me during this research. Where is the line? Is there a line in the wilderness between what behavior is tolerable and what isn't? The reward may be great, but do I have to put up with someone tearing me down or questioning my actual right to exist? Is there a line that shouldn't be crossed? The answer is yes. Participants who put true belonging into practice talked openly about their boundaries. In fact, this research confirms what I found in my earlier work. The clearer and more respected the boundaries, the higher the level of empathy and compassion for others. Fewer clear boundaries, less openness. It's hard to stay kind-hearted when you feel people are taking advantage of you or threatening you. As I looked through the data, I saw that that line was drawn at physical safety and what people were calling emotional safety. Physical safety made sense. Physical safety is one of the non-negotiable prerequisites for vulnerability. We can't allow ourselves to be vulnerable and open if we're not physically safe. Emotional safety was a little more ambiguous. This is especially so in a world where the term emotional safety is often used to mean, you know, I don't have to listen to any point of view that's different than mine, that I don't like, that I think is wrong, that will hurt my feelings, or that's not up to my standards of political correctness. I needed to probe deeper for clarity. When I asked participants for examples of feeling emotionally unsafe or threatened, a clear pattern emerged. They were not talking about getting their feelings hurt are being forced to listen to dissenting opinion. They were talking about dehumanizing language and behavior. I recognized this immediately. I've studied dehumanization and seen it in my work for over a decade. David Smith, the author of Less Than Human, explains that dehumanization is a response to conflicting motives. We want to harm a group of people, but it goes against our wiring as members of a social species to actually harm, kill, torture, or degrade other humans. Smith explains that there are very deep and natural inhibitions that prevent us from treating other people like animals, game, or dangerous predators. He writes, "Dehumanization is a way of subverting those inhibitions." Dehumanization is a process. I think Michelle Mays, the chair of the philosophy department at Emmanuel College, lays it out in a way that makes sense. So I'll use some of her work here to walk us through it. Mays defines dehumanization as the psychological process of demonizing the enemy, making them seem less than human and hence not worthy of humane treatment. Dehumanizing often starts with creating an enemy image. As we take sides, lose trust, and get angrier and angrier, we not only solidify an idea of our enemy, but we also start to lose our ability to listen, communicate, and practice even a modicum of empathy. Once we see people on the other side of a conflict as morally inferior and even dangerous, the conflict starts being framed as good versus evil. Mays writes, "Once the parties have framed the conflict in this way, their positions become more rigid. In some cases, zero-sum thinking develops as parties come to believe that they must either secure their own victory or face defeat. New goals to punish or destroy the opponent arise, and in some cases, more militant leadership comes into power." Dehumanization has fueled innumerable acts of violence, human rights violations, war crimes, and genocides. It makes slavery, torture, and human trafficking possible. Dehumanizing others is the process by which we become accepting of violations against human nature, the human spirit, and for many of us, violations against the central tenets of our faith. How does this happen? Mays explains that most of us believe that people's basic human rights should not be violated, that crimes like murder, rape, and torture are wrong. Successful dehumanizing, however, creates moral exclusion. Groups targeted based on their identity, their gender, ideology, skin color, ethnicity, religion, age, are depicted as less than, or criminal, or even evil. The targeted group eventually falls out of the scope of who is naturally protected by our moral code. This is moral exclusion, and dehumanization is at its core. Dehumanizing always starts with language, often followed by images. We see this throughout history. During the Holocaust, Nazis described Jews as Untermenschen, subhuman. They called Jews rats and depicted them as disease-carrying rodents in everything from military pamphlets to children's books. Hutus involved in the Rwanda genocide called Tutsis cockroaches. Indigenous people are often referred to as savages. Serbs called Bosnians aliens. Slave owners throughout history considered slaves subhuman animals. Look, I know it's hard to believe that we ourselves could ever get to a place where we would exclude people from equal moral treatment, from our basic moral values, but we're fighting biology here. We're hardwired to believe what we see and to attach meaning to the words we hear. We can't pretend that every citizen who participated in or was a bystander to human atrocities was a violent psychopath. That is not possible, it's not true, and it misses the point. The point is that we are all vulnerable to the slow and insidious practice of dehumanizing. Therefore, we are all responsible for recognizing it and stopping it. The courage to embrace our humanity. Because so many time-worn systems of power have placed certain people outside the realm of what we see as human, Much of our work now is more a matter of rehumanizing. That starts in the same place dehumanizing starts, with words and images. Today, we are edging closer and closer to a world where political and ideological discourse has become an exercise in dehumanization. And social media are the primary platforms for our dehumanizing behavior. On Twitter and Facebook, we can rapidly push the people with whom we disagree into the dangerous territory of moral exclusion, with little to no accountability, and often in complete anonymity. Here's what I believe. Number one, if you're offended or hurt when you hear Hillary Clinton or Maxine Waters called bitch, whore, or the C word, you should be equally offended and hurt when you hear those same words used to describe Ivanka Trump, Kellyanne Conway, or Theresa May. Number two, if you felt belittled when Hillary Clinton called Trump supporters a basket of deplorables, then you should have felt equally concerned when Eric Trump said Democrats aren't even human. Number three, when the President of the United States calls women dogs or talks about grabbing pussy, we should get chills down our spine and resistance flowing through our veins. When people call the President of the United States a pig, we should reject that language regardless of our politics and demand discourse that doesn't make people subhuman. Number four, when we hear people referred to as animals or aliens, we should immediately wonder, is this an attempt to reduce someone's humanity so we can get away with hurting them or denying them basic human rights? And number five, if you're offended by a meme of Trump photoshopped to look like Hitler, then you shouldn't have Obama photoshopped to look like the Joker on your Facebook feed. Look, there is a line. It is etched from dignity. And raging, fearful people from the right and left are crossing it at unprecedented rates every single day. We must never tolerate dehumanization, the primary instrument of violence that has been used in every genocide recorded throughout history. When we engage in dehumanizing rhetoric or promote dehumanizing images, we diminish our own humanity in the process. When we reduce Muslim people to terrorists, or Mexicans to illegals, or police officers to pigs, it says nothing at all about the people we're attacking. It does, however, say volumes about who we are and the degree to which we are operating in our integrity. Dehumanizing and holding people accountable are mutually exclusive. Humiliation and dehumanizing are not accountability or social justice tools. They're emotional offloading at best, and emotional self-indulgence at worst. And if our faith asks us to find the face of God in everyone we meet, that should include the politicians, media, and strangers on Twitter with whom we most violently disagree. When we desecrate their divinity, we desecrate our own and we betray our faith. Challenging ourselves to live by higher standards requires constant diligence and awareness. We're so saturated by these words and images, we're close to normalizing moral exceptions. In addition to diligence and awareness, we need courage. Dehumanizing works because people who speak out against what are often sophisticated enemy image campaigns, or people who fight to make sure that all of us are morally included in extended basic human rights, often face harsh consequences. An important example is the debate around Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, and All Lives Matter. Can you believe that Black Lives Matter and also care deeply about the well-being of police officers? Of course. Can you care about the well-being of police officers and at the same time be concerned about abuses of power and systemic racism in law enforcement and the criminal justice system? Yes. I have relatives who are police officers, and I cannot tell you how deeply I care about their safety and well-being. I do almost all of my pro bono work with the military and public servants like the police. I care. And when we care, we should all want just systems that reflect the honor and dignity of the people who serve in those systems. But then, if it's the case that we can care about citizens and the police, shouldn't the rallying cry just be, hey, all lives matter? No, because the humanity wasn't stripped from all lives the way it was stripped from the lives of Black citizens. In order for slavery to work, in order for us to buy, sell, beat and trade people like animals. Americans had to completely dehumanize slaves. And whether we directly participated in that or were simply a member of a culture that at one time normalized that behavior, it shaped us. We can't undo that level of dehumanizing in one or two generations. I believe Black Lives Matter is a movement to rehumanize Black citizens. All lives matter, but not all lives need to be pulled back into moral inclusion. Not all people were subjected to the psychological process of demonizing and being made less than human, so we could justify the inhumane practice of slavery. Is there tension and vulnerability in supporting both the police and the activists? Hell yes. It's the wilderness. But most of the criticism comes from people who are intent on forcing these false either-or dichotomies and shaming us for not hating the right people. It's definitely messier taking a nuanced stance, but it's also critically important to true belonging. Another example of straddling the tension of supporting a system we love and holding it accountable comes from one of the research participants, a former athlete from Penn State. He took a strong stand as an advocate for the abuse survivors who suffered due to the silence of the football program and Joe Paterno's protection of Jerry Sandusky. He said he couldn't believe how hateful some of his friends were, friends that he'd known for 30 years. He said, "When you love a place like we love Penn, you fight to make it better, to own our problems and fix them. You don't pretend that everything's okay. That's not loyalty or love. That's fear." When the culture of any organization mandates that it's more important to protect the reputation of a system and those in power than it is to protect the basic human dignity of the individuals who serve that system or who are served by that system, you can be certain that shame is systemic, money is driving ethics, and that accountability is all but dead. This is true in corporations, nonprofits, universities, governments, faith communities, schools, families, and sports programs. If you think back on any major scandal fueled by cover-ups, you'll see the same pattern. And the restitution and resolution of cover-ups almost always happens in the wilderness when one person steps outside their bunker and speaks the truth. As we think about our journey from fitting in to striding into the wilderness of true belonging, we will be well served by understanding and recognizing the boundaries of respecting everyone's physical safety and not participating in experiences or communities that utilize language and/or engage in behaviors that dehumanize people. I think calling the latter emotional safety is inaccurate. We're not talking about hurt feelings. We're talking about the very foundation of physical danger and violence. Conflict transformation. In addition to the courage to be vulnerable and the willingness to practice our braving skills, moving closer means we need tools for navigating conflict. I asked my friend and colleague, Dr. Michelle Buck, to help us out. Buck is a clinical professor of leadership at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where she served as the school's first director of leadership initiatives. She spent the past 20 years teaching conflict transformation. Her approach has the potential to change how we handle ourselves in conflict. I'm going to read my interview with her to you. I want you to hear her words directly. They're very powerful. So I said to Dr. Buck, "Sometimes when I get overwhelmed, my default is agree to disagree and shut it down. What do you think about this approach?" Here's what she told me. People often silence themselves or agree to disagree without fully exploring the actual nature of the disagreement for the sake of protecting a relationship and maintaining connection. But when we avoid certain conversations and never fully learn how the other person feels about all of the issues, we sometimes end up making assumptions that not only perpetuate but deepen misunderstandings, and that can generate resentment. These results are sometimes worse for the relationship than just having the so-called argument would be. The key is to learn how to navigate conflicts or differences of opinion in a way that deepens mutual understanding, even if two people still disagree. Imagine that. After a meaningful conversation, two people could actually have increased mutual understanding, greater mutual respect, and better connection, but still completely disagree. This is very different from avoiding a conversation and not learning more about the other party. The second question really came from one of my own struggles. The question was, if we decide to be brave and stay in the conversation, how do we push through the vulnerability and stay civil? Here's Dr. Buck's response. One of the key pieces of advice I give my executive and graduate students is to explicitly address the underlying intentions. What is the conversation about, and what is it really about? This sounds simple, but tends to be easier said than done. The intention is the deepest level reason why the topic is so important to the person. We have to understand what truly matters to us and learn why this topic is so important to the other person as well. For example, two family members may bitterly disagree about the planning of a family event. One or both of them may have an underlying intention of wanting to create more opportunities for the family to stay connected, which may sound very different than the details of the disagreement. Speaking our intention does not mean that we will suddenly have the same preferences or opinions, but it often helps us navigate difficult conversations and maintain or build connection by actually understanding each other's motives and interests more closely. Here was my next question for Dr. Buck. One of my worst defenses when I get anxious or fearful in conflict is to put people on the stand. I break into like vicious lawyer mode and depose people rather than listening. Last week you said this and now you're saying this. Are you lying now or are you lying then? It's terrible and it always ends badly, but it's how I get to being right. What's the solution? Dr. Buck's response. That's a common strategy for people, but if you want to transform a disagreement into an opportunity for connection, you need to distinguish between past, present, and future. When disagreements revolve around what happened in the past, it's easy to fall into countless volleys of you said, I said, back and forth. Focusing on what did or didn't happen in the past, or what past events led to the current situation, usually increases tension and decreases connection. A critical first step is to shift the focus to where are we now? And the most important turning point comes when we focus on the future. What are we trying to accomplish for the future? What do we want our relationship to be going forward? And what do we need to do, even if we still disagree, to create that future? What do we want for our family in the future, or for our team, or our faith community, or our industry? This shift in focus does not necessarily mean we agree, but it may help us identify agreement about a shared future that we want to create together. I told Dr. Buck that I really like that she uses the term conflict transformation, not resolution, because it feels more about connection to me in some way. I asked her to explain the difference. Dr. Buck said, "In all of my work, I choose to focus on conflict transformation rather than the more traditional term conflict resolution. To me, the latter suggests going back to a previous state of affairs and has a connotation that there may be a winner or a loser. How will the disagreement be resolved? Whose solution will be selected as the better one? In contrast, I choose to focus on conflict transformation, suggesting that by creatively navigating the conversation